Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Garth Greenwell. His novel is What Belongs to You. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's a first book. It's a very powerful book. And I'm going to do something unusual today because I have the feeling that between what I would say the book is about and what Garth would say the book is about, there might be an abyss. So tell me, what is the book about?
Oh, that's such a hard question.
Well, have fun with it.
Okay. Well, you know, there's the story of the book, and that's easy to talk about. I mean, the story is about what I hope it's a kind of love story, but a strained and strange love story between an American high school teacher living in Bulgaria and a younger Bulgarian man whom he meets in a public toilet beneath Sofia's National Palace of Culture, and whom he pays for sex. And, you know, that seems at first like a very kind of clean transaction and then becomes very humanly messy. And he finds himself caught by this man in ways that challenge certain defenses he's built around his life. I think it's very much a book about desire, and I think it's very much a book about shame. And I think that it's a book about a shame that maybe that is, you know, not unrelated to the shame that we're familiar with from, you know, gay books of a certain tradition in which I hope my book is participating.
What tradition is that?
Well, I mean, the tradition of Giovanni's Room, you know, the tradition of...
Absolutely.
You know, a sort of person who is in an antagonistic relationship with his own desire. But it's also, I think, a different kind of shame because my narrator is out. He is comfortable with a gay identity. He's someone who has been, you know, kind of immersed in a language and a philosophy of activism around gay rights. And so, you know, it's someone who has learned that all the lessons he was taught about his life as a child were wrong and were bankrupt and really understands that, but is also still the person who was shaped by those lessons.
Fascinating, because for me, okay, now the interpenetration of interpretation begins. What I thought you would say is that this is a book in which a man tells about his love for a male prostitute, but never allows this prostitute to speak. That what we read is an entire novel in which none of the characters have names except for the prostitute, and yet the prostitute's behaviors are reported, but everything is coming to us through the narrator, who is effectively blocking us from knowing how anyone feels and who is well practiced in concealing from himself his own feelings.
I mean, I do think that, you know, one of the things this narrator finds in the transaction with which the book begins, which he tells us it's the first time he's ever paid for sex. And I think one of the things that that transaction promises him is a kind of structure that allows for the satisfaction of desire accompanied by the pain of exclusion, which is kind of the lesson he was taught as a child, that that was what desire entailed. But I think that that distance is not as durable as he would like it to be. And that actually Mitko challenges that distance. And it's true, you know, and it was very clear to me from the very beginning that we would not enter Mitko's thoughts. And I did feel that that sort of mystery of Mitko had to be respected. At the same time, it also became very clear to me that if Mitko is not available to the reader as an object of empathy, independent of his role in the book, you know, to cause the narrator to have thoughts and feelings, that the book has failed. And it became very important to me then to describe as carefully as possible this person and this person's body in space, so that there is information, even though the book is very interior and everything is filtered through the consciousness of the narrator. I hope that there is information available to the reader that the reader might interpret in a way different from the narrator. And so we don't have access to any kind of authoritative statement of what Mitko is experiencing, but I hope there is evidence that allows for the story the narrator tells to not be the only possible story.
For some reason, that mixture of closeness and anonymity is crucial to his sense of what arousal is.
I mean, I think he comes to really fear that. You know, to the extent that my narrator grows or sort of has a kind of moral arc, and I'm not sure how great that extent is. I mean, I do think he's a limited guy. I think it is in how he defines love. Because I think he has bought into an idea of love. He's a poet. And I think he has bought into an idea of love that's very closely tied to an idea he has about art, which is, you know, that old idea that Iris Murdoch loved.
No, I don't know that idea. Tell me.
This idea that love is looking.
That love is looking.
That love is looking. That love is observation. That if you look at a thing long enough and with all of your moral faculties, that's what love is. And I think the narrator has really believed that and has believed that kind of turning the world into poems is a way of loving it. But then he changes that, or he comes to a different understanding of love through this relationship with Mitko. And he says at a certain moment, love isn't just looking at something, but looking with it, facing what it faces. That love is binding your destiny to another person and to another place, because Mitko and Bulgaria are very tied together for this narrator. And I think the narrator does come to a very frightening realization or possible realization about himself, which is that he's just not able to do that.
I'm talking to Garth Greenwell about a novel, What Belongs to You. It's published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux, and I wanted to ask, what does the title mean?
So the title is actually taken from one of my favorite books, which is Thomas Mann's Death in Venice.
I had the feeling. Okay.
And it's that amazing scene where the barber is convincing Aschenbach to let him dye his hair and put makeup on him to make him look younger, because he senses that he's in love. And he says, "Permit me to restore what belongs to you."
Wow. Oh, so Thomas Mann, as usual, says it all.
He does. He got there first.
And again, tell me, is some of the power, people are responding to this book with high praise and a lot of attention has attached itself to the book immediately. And I wondered whether there's a certain amount of interest in it because it's so much not the book one expects to be reading in the era of gay marriage.
You know, maybe that's true. I mean, there are versions of queer life that have become more difficult to talk about and to value in the age of marriage equality. And, you know, when I talk about this, I always want to say that I think marriage equality was a crucial fight, and it's really important that we won it. And the protections, especially for queer families, that come with marriage equality are necessary. I also think we lose a great deal if, instead of really being a project of liberation, which I think must mean multiplying the legitimate models of life, it becomes instead a kind of homogenization of queer life and makes only one model seem valid.
Well, I wanted to ask this. You say that for your narrator, I suspect for you as well, that you're looking at the experience in this novel as a source of art. The bourgeois novel, which is the novel of marriage, is famously the bourgeois novel. That is to say, it's not an art novel. It tells us the way we live now. It wants to tell us what our life is like in our suburbs, in our private houses, among our property. The art novel is like James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room, or like the novels of Jean Genet, novels that are without a sense of appropriate ownership, property, as opposed to rental.
Right.
That this book wants to restore the possibility of a kind of high passion which is aligned to an emotion available in works of art like Death in Venice and maybe not as available in life. What do you think?
I don't know what I think. You know, it does seem to me that there is a tradition, or there are traditions of queer art in which there is an assertion of this kind of passion that has a value that is disconnected from duration. And I think that's true in Genet, in something like Querelle, and I think that's true in Whitman, and I think that's the experience of cruising. And I think that, you know, those places like where my book begins, you know, I guess I would say, no, I do think those emotions are available in life. You know, and one of the things I wanted to do in this book is to write about these places like the bathrooms at the National Palace of Culture, which have been so disparaged by both straight culture and a kind of, you know, homonormative activist language, and that have been talked about in discourses of disease and in discourses of a dirtiness that's not just about place but also about people. And to me, these places, since I was 14 years old, have been places of extraordinary emotional richness and community and nourishment. And I wanted to write about them in a way that does honor to the rich places that they are. They are not these flattened out places. They're places where human beings have face-to-face encounters, which means that all that is human is possible in them. And I wanted to write about them in that way. And I also wanted to write about them in a way that, I mean, yes, is attached to these art traditions that queer people have claimed for themselves as sources of value that are not the bourgeois family, that are not the kind of socially recognized structures of value. You know, I wanted to write about this experience in the way that opera addresses this experience.
Yes, that's what I mean. I think that one of the pleasures of reading This Belongs to You is that although the experiences are realistic and expressed more or less in a realistic style, there's a certain kind of operatic intensity, a focus, an over-focusedness, a kind of, because it's all soliloquy, an aria nature to the book that seems to me to participate in a feeling of the ecstatic. I'm not complaining about this. I mean, who doesn't prefer to experience ecstasy? I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We're talking about What Belongs to You. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Garth Greenwell about his latest book, What Belongs to You, Where an American Teacher's Life Changes. In his transactions, which go from monetary to emotional over the course of a book, with a Bulgarian prostitute. This is Garth Greenwell reading from toward the end of the first third of his novel, What Belongs to You.
And I think just one note, which is that there's a Bulgarian word that appears in the first sentences that's the word priatel, which is the Bulgarian word for friend. It's also the Bulgarian word for boyfriend, and it's also the word that Mitko uses for the men who pay him for sex. I didn't respond to his smile. I came all the way from Sofia, I said, and I've paid for the room, for our meals, for everything. I came to be with you, to have sex with you. And here Mitko broke in, catching the scent of something he could exploit. Is it just about sex, then? He said. You're my friend. And he used again that word, priatel. I found the hotel, he said. I waited for you at the bus stop, even though it was raining, and now my throat hurts. I'm starting to get sick. Ane Liviarno, he said. Isn't that right? Challenging me to deny it. He paused to drink, as though bracing himself for a confrontation he knew he couldn't avoid. I did all that because we're friends, he said. Those are things friends do. It isn't just sex for me. He stopped then, as if he realized he had gone too far, had leaned too hard on the fiction of our relationship and felt the false surface give way. But we aren't friends like that, I said as Mitko took another long drink. We both get something from it, I went on, and the bluntness of the language was now the tool I wanted. I get sex, I said, and you get money, that's all. But now I was the one who had gone too far, and so I softened what I had said, or tried to. I like you, I said. I like being with you. Skupsi me, I said. You're dear to me. You're beautiful. But Mikko's expression had hardened. He set down his glass and placed both of his hands on his knees. When have I ever said no to you? He asked, and it was true. Though he had delayed and put me off, he had always given in when I insisted. He had never truly refused. The trouble with you is you don't know what you want, he said. You say one thing and then another. I knew he was right, and not just about my relationship with him. Always I feel an ambivalence that spurs me first in one direction and then another, a habit that has done much damage. I didn't deny what he said. I even nodded in agreement, at which his mood only darkened. I'm not like that, he went on. I'm a man of my word. If I say that I'm through with you, I'm through. I won't change my mind. And if I see you again, if we pass each other in the street, in Sofia, in Plovdiv, in Varna, it doesn't matter where, I'll pretend I don't know you, he said. I won't even say hello. Is that what you want? He said. And then, without pausing for me to respond, be careful. There wasn't anything playful or warm about him now, though he sat naked in front of me. He was entirely unavailable. Be sure you tell the truth, he said. Be sure you say what you mean. But how could I say what I meant, I thought, when that meaning so entirely escaped me? I looked at him without speaking, at the length of him folded in the chair. It was a way of delaying an answer, but it was also a valedictory look. I was taking him in with a sense already of regret. He saw me looking as he poured himself another drink, his third or fourth in a short time. The effects of it were beginning to show, and again I had the thought, more troubling now, that he was steeling himself for something to come. Well, he said, which is it? And though I hadn't come any closer to a decision, I felt pressed to meet his tone, a pressure I was grateful for since it freed me from having to choose. Yes, I said then, yes, I think that's best, but I didn't stop there. I'm sorry, I said, I'm sorry. And then, this is sad for me. Tujnumye.
That was Garth Greenwell reading from What Belongs to You. And you see, I think that this narrator has been trapped here in this section to representing someone who he has a problem calling him a friend. He has a problem saying that it's anything more than a transaction. And yet there's no problem on a certain level. This is pain being represented on both sides.
Yes, and it's also ambivalence and ambiguity. And I would say that, you know, in this novel, I mean, if you want to kind of distinguish this from a sort of realist mode, which I'm never 100% sure what we mean by realism, but, you know, if you want, because the novel is aligned with opera and with lyric poetry and with the queer traditions of writing that live in those realms, like Giovanni's Room, like Genet, like Proust. I hope that it is a book that's interested in those kind of extremes of feeling and ecstasy. But I think it's also a book that lives very much in the realm of ambivalence. And I think that, and of disappointment. And, you know, I think that arias do give us access to those emotional territories as well. I don't think it's just an experience of highs and lows. It's also the experience, you know, my narrator ends up getting embroiled in the very unecstatic reality of the Bulgarian public health system, you know.
There have been those who've argued that those traditions come from the closet, that the heightened sound is itself the sound of someone who has to pierce the closet door in order to be heard.
They say the same things about cruising.
Yes, they do. I think we haven't yet gotten to the point where we're going to figure out where shame can end, where embarrassment ends. These are all things we all fear, and not just gay men and women. Heterosexuals have trouble talking about it too. I think the beginning of this conversation, even within the novel, is just starting. That's what's so exciting about this book.
Well, I mean, I think that's true. Those arguments, I think, are embarrassed by the fact that these modes remain vital and available and of use. And that's as true, you know, cruising persists on 8th Avenue, just blocks from, you know, the enlightened liberated bars of Hell's Kitchen.
You're talking about Manhattan.
Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, this idea that cruising is merely, you know, this shadowy thing happening, you know, sort of underground by men who are ashamed, I think is just not true. And I guess it seems odd to me to say that, you know, the exuberance and the vitality of these queer traditions, these queer aesthetic traditions, are merely functions of the closet. I think that's just wrong. And it seems to me that, again, that argument too would be embarrassed by the fact that queer artists, and I think especially young queer artists, are finding these modes, you know, realms of great possibility, even as we are in this moment where we are not feeling the same kinds of shame as we, as, you know, David in Giovanni's room feels. You know, these modes remain meaningful to us, I think.
And, you know, this book has decided to go as far as it can to make sure that this interaction between the narrator and Mitko is not trivial, is not brief in duration, has real consequences, and lives in the reader's mind well after the last page of a short novel.
It is a great privilege to be read in that way. Thank you.
Well, I guess the privilege is mine. Thank you for joining me. I've been talking to Garth Greenwell, the author of What Belongs to You, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
I want to say that sometimes it's very important that a novel be the occasion for difficult conversation, and that if it's not had, it hasn't been as good a novel as one's thought. That's where we have to go. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from What Belongs to You at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is functioning today as co-producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Today, our engineer is Philip Richards. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Valeria Luiselli is our guest.